Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. I'm sorry we're about 2 minutes late getting started this morning. Well, we could do that. The only person that has announcements that gets crunched is me, so it's really no problem. All right, on your page 45, we ended the slides on lesson 10 last week. We were talking about the extent of benevolence, what churches can do, what individuals can do with respect to that subject. And so today, we're to consider the questions on that lesson. So, the first question is, who should not get any benevolent help? And then you have this passage indicated in your lesson. 2 Thessalonians 3, 10 through 12 is the text we use to answer this question. For even when we were with you, Paul writing to the church in Thessalonica, we used to give you this order: if anyone will not work, neither let him eat. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. So your question is, who should not get benevolent help? Gerald?
Those not willing to work.
Okay. Is that just related to members of the local church?
It's anybody.
That passage is a universal passage. It applies to all. Well, are you saying to me that if I know somebody is out of a job, that's not what the passage says? This is, are you willing to work? That passage indicates if anyone will not work. There's the difference. We had that situation with a couple here a few years back, and we refused to help them individually or out of the treasury, and they were both Christians. We applied that passage to it, and the situation got corrected. So that's very important.
Excuse me. Part two of that answer is non-Christians.
Yes. Well, you're right. Sure. So it's universal. It applies to everyone. So what about the panhandlers out on the medians in our streets?
Well, you don't know if you work or not.
It's a matter of judgment with them, with every one of us.
Absolutely,
that's
it
individual.
Is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sometimes I help and sometimes I don't.
Sure. Sometimes. There was a situation in Dallas. A couple of us were there on a little business lunch at the Black Eyed Pea, pardon me, down on Loop 12. And we walked out, and everybody got in their cars. I walked over with them to talk a little more, and then I went back to my car, and here's a guy sitting there. And he wanted to know if I would help him. And I said, well, what do you need? He said, I'm hungry. And I said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go right inside this restaurant, and I'll feed you. And he thanked me for that. And I wasn't going to stay there. I just told the manager, give him whatever he wants, and I'll wait until you tally the bill, and then I'll pay you. Will he work? I don't know. And I didn't care. I didn't get into that conversation. But when you have a known situation, yeah. A brother says, I lost my job. Can we help you? What are you doing? Are you looking around? Now I'm going to let the Lord take care of it. Oh, well, we got a problem happened right here in this congregation. Mm-hmm. You mean you're not going to? God will take care of it. I said, no, he won't.
No.
Because there's a passage in the New Testament that says he won't.
Yeah.
you do your due diligence to find a job, but I've got to see some effort. I'm not going to help you. Richard?
My experience with situations like that is sometimes I have time to talk with them and converse and find out their particulars of that situation, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just take them into the restaurant, like you say, pay for the meal and leave because I've got other appointments and I don't have time to find out.
Right.
You know, and other times you've got time to converse with them and find out if they're amenable to listening to the gospel or not.
True. Okay, good point. Question number two. How important is it to God that we take care of our own families?
We're commanded to do that.
Absolutely, we're commanded to do it.
We're categorized as worse than infidels if we don't.
Right. Good point. All right. Anybody else? All right. Question number three. Read the qualifications of widows indeed, 1 Timothy 5, 9 through 10. Are there any you would like to discuss in class? Well, here's the passage. Let a widow be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works. And if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. Wow. Look at that verse 10. What are we going to do with that? I want to point out one thing in the end of the first sentence, beginning of the second, verse 10. And if she has brought up children, could she be a widow without children?
Yes.
Of course she could. That could be something that you just don't consider if she doesn't have children. Steve?
She should be a widow that's never been married. Absolutely. I would say
Sure Absolutely. She can be. Yeah, sure she can be. So what do you think about that? Gerald?
I have a question. Being the wife of one man, what happens if she had been widowed early in her life and she had married again?
She has before.
Well, maybe.
And well, he died.
Maybe if that family died off also, and she is... So is that considered one man? I mean... Okay, that one was very short, but then she'd been with this second one for, you know, a long time.
Well,
so I mean, that just kind of hit me. I hadn't had any issues with any of them, and it's all of a sudden it just hit.
Okay, notice what book we're in, 1 Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
What about the qualifications for an elder? It's the same situation. Big argument existed back in the 70s with a member here in a Bible class I was teaching and demanded that I retract the statement that person could never be an elder if he had been married before. And I said, what about a scriptural remarriage? Wife dies. He's scripturally... He can remarry again scripturally. Yes, but then that's two wives.
Yeah.
I said, but it's only one at a time.
That's right. And it was done scripturally.
That's correct. Steve?
Yeah, Bill. Part of that argument that evaluates that, and still to this day, I've studied this a bunch, and still to this day, it's if the context of everything where they talk about the wife of one person and that singular marriage... there's the discussion as to, and a lot of people forget that polygamy was a widely practiced
Absolutely.
Thing among the Jewish people during
right.
this time.
Right.
And that, if you look at the whole context, my conclusion has been this is primarily targeted at polygamy. That's not to say that you can just throw your wife
yeah.
away, but that's primarily what all this was targeted
Yeah, and I think you're on the right track yeah. there with
yeah.
it. So you look at those qualifications, and our question is to go back to it. Read the qualification of widows indeed. Are there any you would like to discuss in class? Well, we're talking about some of them here. If she washed the saints' feet, I don't want anyone washing my feet.
That's a general reference to caring for individuals.
All right. Got to understand the context, and as Steve pointed out, the time, customs and things. If you wore sandals and walked in the desert, washing saints' feet is an indication or an example of hospitality.
And it's also showing she is humble to the saints. She right. would do it, you know, serve in any capacity right. she could to them.
So if I bring verse 10 down to today, and there's a lady 62 years old that cannot support herself, what of those qualifications there? I got the 60 years old and the one man, the wife of one man, but what about those qualifications down there? What's one thing we studied we have to be sure of?
Does she have family to take care of?
There you go.
That's right.
Diane?
The way I look at that, the first phrase in verse 10, having a reputation for good works, the remainder of that verse is, to use today's jargon, unpacking what are good works. It's as if they say having a reputation for good works. For example, if she's brought up children, if she's shown hospitality, if she has washed. So they're just saying, this is the kind of good work that she should have been and has a reputation for engaging in.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Exactly.
That's a good explanation. Richard?
And arguments by those that say we have to be specific to those types of good behavior, I say Phariseeism is prevalent today.
Absolutely, it is.
If you're sticking with exact particulars, you know, well, we don't wash saints' feet today, so that doesn't apply. But there are other things that do apply.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How about a card in the mail to show kindness and empathy or sympathy to someone? How about a telephone call? How about a greeting?
Yeah.
You have the reputation of being a servant of the Lord, not just to Christians, but to all. So, okay. All right. Question number 4. What are some important lessons we can learn from Matthew 25, 31 through 46? Now, what I've decided to do with this for interest of answering the question, there are a lot of verses here. I've placed all of them on separate slides, and I want us to go through it and then address the question. So at the beginning, Jesus is talking here in Matthew 25. But when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before Him. And He will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And He'll put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. Then the King will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave Me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave Me drink. I was a stranger, and you invited Me in. Naked, and you clothed Me. I was sick, and you visited Me. I was in prison, and you came to Me. Then the righteous will answer Him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or and feed you or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in and naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the King will answer and say to them, truly, I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry. You gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty. You gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. Then they themselves will also answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison, didn't take care of you? Then he'll answer them, saying, truly, I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these shall go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. What are some important lessons we can learn from this passage?
Take care of one another.
Take care of one another. A brother once said to me in this congregation, when members of the church were cutting our own grass here, he said to me, I consider it worship when I crank that mower up and cut this grass. I didn't have the foggiest idea what he was talking about. But that comment stuck with me. And later I got it figured out. And he was right. Don?
I forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, just take your hand up if it happens again. Julie?
When you asked a while ago, you know, what does that mean to us to take care of the needs of others, basically? Number one, you have to have a heart and a mindset that is not focused inward. You have to be looking for opportunities. Now, obviously, some are going to be blatant, and you're going to say, oh, I need to do this. Or that person needs help or love or care.
Right.
Or and there are other times when you're not sure what's going on, but you need, at least for me, I feel like I need to see a situation. When I see a situation, could there be a need there? And even if there's not, just say, you know, would you like a ride for this or that, or, you know, whatever it is. And at least be willing to look to others, look at others and see what you can do to help, even okay. if they don't really need you.
Right, okay. James?
When they keep saying the least of these, did they judge people by the, you going by their occupation or how good looking they are, or how do you judge people?
No.
Say the least, if you're a garbage man, would be different from the president of a banker.
No.
Why to say the least?
Okay, anybody want to answer that?
I would like to.
All right, Steve?
Because that goes to the heart of this whole passage, I think, is that we have heard Christ throughout the New Testament, we've heard Christ talk about not doing your prayers to be seen by men, not to give alms to be seen by men. It's all about unconditional love. And that's what the context of this all is about. And that's what he's talking about here, is the exercising of unconditional love that expects nothing in return. And because if you give to those that are in high places that are visually seen by others, that's one thing. To give to the person that no one knows you gave it to. So the context of this is unconditional love that expects nothing in return. And he's talked about this in several places, in several applications, not just here.
Right.
But to me, this frames it very well as to what he's talking about.
Don't look on people. Houses they own, cars they drive, clothes they wear. Don't look at that at all. Don't ever do that. If there is a need and you can fill it, fill it. And don't tell me about it. Do it as if nobody's looking. Gerald?
A good parallel to this passage is the parable of the Good Samaritan. What did the priest and the Pharisee do? they looked upon him and said, no, this is a Samaritan. This is a somebody truly the least of their in their eyes.
Right.
And not worthy. And so that falls into the ones that, well, when did we not do this? Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't do it to this gentleman right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who did do it? One of the least did it unto the least. Mm-hmm. And what does Jesus say? Those that are last shall be first. Well, that's what this is saying. It doesn't matter who it is. You are going to be a servant unto them. Jesus humbled himself. This is deity. Humbling himself to what? Serve his disciples in washing their feet. And hence serve them in other capacities more than once. So that is two good parallel passages that you can...
There are. And that's good that you brought them up.
Answer the least answer.
Right. Richard?
You can see by the questions that they asked that if they had known someone was the Lord of higher rank, they would have been glad to do this.
Absolutely.
But they were hesitant to do it for the least.
Right.
And Christ is pointing out the error of their ways.
Right. Steve.
And another answer to James is yes, they had a caste system back then.
Yeah.
They did have a system that established this person was better than this person. And in fact, I have four Indian engineers that work for me that are in four different castes from India, and it still exists in Hindu today.
Right.
And that's the first thing I have to do with guys that come out of a caste system to make sure they understand that
right. You're
not one anymore.
I get from that the least of these,
yeah.
I get that that's a big inclusive term. Don't separate them by who's great, who's least. It's not the point.
That's not that point.
The point is to do something. And Christ is raking them over the coals for not doing it.
And you do something because it's not necessarily to whom you're helping. It is you're glorifying God in that you are imitating his example that he helped what? He came and died for us, who is definitely far lesser than he is.
And this passage right here in the New Testament, his preaching about this subject is so vitally important. We just cannot overlook it at all. And someone said, I forgot who, I think it was Julie, though, you have to have a willing heart. This has to be a part of your... Hey, Elaine, spiritual DNA. I won't forget it. It was a good comment. Thanks very much. All right, question number 5. How much responsibility does each individual Christian have in the area of benevolence? We're talking about individual Christian here.
A lot.
Okay. Joe?
It's a lot, but you can't go beyond what you can do. Right. You can't help.
Yeah.
Right.
But the ones that can are me, do what I can do.
Yeah.
If I've got $2 and he's hungry, give him one.
Yeah.
I have a friend in Houston, member of the church,
yes.
Former elder. There was a situation in congregation of 400 people. Where a couple were going to lose their home because he was out of a job, she was ill, and they couldn't pay the mortgage off. You know what he did? He didn't do a whole lot. He told me about it privately because I don't know the names, and he knew I would never reveal the names, even if I knew them. He just paid off the mortgage. Guess who he told? I know he told me, but I don't think anybody else, maybe members of his family knew. That wasn't broadcast around. He took them aside. He took care of it. He could. If I had known the same need, I promise you, I could not have done it. I don't have that kind of wealth. But he did and he could. That scripture we just looked at. Okay?
And sometimes in situations similar to that, maybe not hang off the you might be able to lead them to someone who can, or talk to someone who might be able to, and have them go up to the Irma.
Yeah. I've seen countless examples, large and small. The key is, if you know about it and you can help it, do it. Don?
There's a lot of judgment going that we have to place on situations that come across. Way back in my own life, when I was in the service, walking along a street here in California, and all there was panhandlers. It's just common. You walk down the street and there's every corner or halfway through the block, someone would come up you and want it. We have to make a judgment. Sometimes when they came up to me and asked me for a handout, I'd refuse because the first thing you could do is you couldn't stand their breath. They breathed, oh my goodness alive. I mean, all it is liquor. You know, I mean, it's just overwhelming. But they need money. Well, for what? To go over and get to the bar and get something. That's exactly what they're going to use it for. And it doesn't take a lot of judgment on an individual's part. Now, are you going to help that individual? The best thing you can do is not to give them the money. That's the thing that's helping them, is not giving them the money. You invite them to church or wherever, and they're not going to go, but at the same time, there is a manner that you've got to decide that we don't start casting our pearls before swine.
Right.
There are other cases, and in one case I can recall, an individual came up to me, and this is the way he prefaced his coming up to me. He says, "I'm sorry to bother you, but I haven't eaten for 2 days." Now, I'll tell you, that man was staggering because of lack of food. You could tell that man was sincere, and he couldn't find a job at that point in time, but at the same time, he wasn't asking for something to go out to the bar and drink. He was asking for something to eat. And I did the very same thing as you mentioned earlier. When I said, "Come with me," and because I was passing a restaurant within the next block, and I went in and told that man to sit down and ask the waiter or the manager, whoever it was that was in behind the counter anyway, that if he would take care of him, and I gave him money, and I said, "If he eats more than that, I will be back after church services and make it right with you." And he said, "Fine." And I had to leave, and I told the man that where I was heading. I just couldn't stay around if I was going to get to the church and take care of other obligations. But at the same time, you have to make the judgment.
Yeah.
And if you go and just give it to everyone who asks, you are not fulfilling what God has intended.
And you'll never take care of all of them.
Yeah. You can't. No. There's what no possible way of taking care of them.
What did Christ say? The poor,
you'll always have
with you. Absolutely. That's not licensed to never help anybody. It's just a statement of fact. Right. James, you had your hand up.
Well, it's on the Denton paper today. This clinic for poor people was going out of business. This doctor, his wife was running it, but somebody stepped in and donated money, I think $4,500, to keep it going. Mm-hmm. So think about if you're not conditioned to help somebody, you might find somebody dead.
Yeah.
If you don't have it, say, "Well, I don't have it, but somebody over here has it." Yeah. You might help.
Yeah, we know, Carol, I know very well about that case. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Bill, could I make one final comment?
Yes,
you said, if you know about it and can help, help. I think we have to be careful with the "if you know about it," because we can close our eyes and, as Julie said, close our hearts to being aware of other people's needs. So we have to watch out for that danger, because it's awfully easy to say,
Yeah, that's what the passage says.
That just isn't good enough. That just is not what.
No, it's not. And thank you for pointing that out. James?
Yeah, it's just like somebody, their house is burned down or they've had a bad sickness. Say, well, call me, see anything I can do. Well, if you got any sense at all, they don't have anything. What do you mean, call me? You see, my house is burned down.
You know, that's a good point. That's an extreme case, of course. If their house burned down, you would probably never say that. But we do say that a lot. But we don't say it, I'm persuaded, because we never expect a call. Many times when we use that, we really mean it. But it's not a scapegoat. Just get out of the situation. Carol?
We had that situation with somebody.
Yeah, we did.
And because of that, well, everybody knows who he's been.
She's talking about Joe Miller and Ernest Miller.
Because of that, people came to her rescue, and because of that, her husband, who was not a Christian, looked at that and said, wow, they're helping you. That made a big impression.
If you talk to Joe, she got more help from Christians. She had more than she started with. Her house was burned, had to rebuild back. But we were on vacation when that happened. Our daughter called, and we said, do whatever you need to do and count us in, and we'll take care of it when you get back, Joe.
Bill, Eastside was first responders other than the fire department. So Eastside people have got good hearts. All Christians would if they knew it, but I'm talking about your congregation. They were the first ones there.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. Richard?
When I asked that question of someone, if you need some help, call me, my intent is to not to impose on them my desire to rush in and find out all the circumstances of what went on. Because that person may have family that is willing to help. I don't really need to know that. You know, I'm trusting them to tell me, I'm destitute, you know, you can help me right now. But I don't want to impose on them and inquire as to how much help they've received already.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I see what you're saying.
If they need help, I trust that they're going to ask me for help, and I'm willing to help. But I'm not going to say, you take my help because I'm obligated to give it to them.
Yeah, right, right. Carol?
Also, if any of us need help, that's another part of it. We need to let people know that because they can't help us.
If they don't know.
You know, so we shouldn't keep ourselves so locked up in ourselves so we don't share our problems with them.
Right. James?
I think I've heard Joe say that probably what caused Ernest to become a Christian. He said, if they're that nice, would help us out. I'm going to start going so it served two purposes.
Right. Well, Joe?
But Bill, he didn't do it right off.
No, he didn't.
Okay?
No.
He come by himself one morning and sat down with the matter.
Yeah. But I remember Ernest having very extreme breathing difficulties. Let me tell you something real quick about him. He showed up for Bible class every time. He had his lesson prepared. And his breathing was so hampered that he couldn't sit long in the pew. So he stood up in the back where Kurt is. We had different benches, and back where Kurt is, I was teaching a class, and he leaned over the pew and answered questions. You talk about committed and converted, that was Ernest Miller. You have no idea what that little act that Carol was pointing out about. He was overwhelmed that people he didn't even know would come to rescue them. It's amazing, amazing what you can do when you have the attitude Christ is talking about here. Linda?
He opened his eyes to the fact my mother loved you also.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he sure became my friend quick. Yeah. Okay, we're on question five. How much responsibility?
Actually, we're on question six.
Oh, we did. We're on six. Thank you, Gerald. Discuss one example of each type of benevolent situation. The first one mentioned is a congregation may take care of its own members. What'd you say there? I said not may, but must. There's not any question about that. When you got up out of bed this morning and you realized, awakening from your sleep, that it was the first day of the week, did you start making excuses about coming here? No. I thank God this morning that I got to go to church.
Hallelujah.
I got to go. Don't have to go. Got to go. I don't mean got to and have to. I get to go today. That's what I meant. And I'm persuaded many of you did too. Other churches may send to one church that is unable to take care of its members. You're discussing an example of each type of benevolent situation. You've got a congregation, has a need, cannot fulfill it. What is a scriptural solution to that? Other churches can do it. Romans 15, 25 and 26.
And the key to that statement is the second to last word, that pronoun, its members. Yeah. Not
right.
One church.
Other situations, but members of that church in need.
I couldn't accept this church. Elders cannot accept funds to take care of someone in need here and then take it and give it to some other need.
Correct.
Whether you know it or not.
No.
Your plea for assistance was for this congregation. It has to stay here. Okay.
And we've known of several instances throughout the years, like hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, where something has happened in an area, usually one particular geographical area, and they're just overwhelmed and the local congregation can't.
Yeah. And physically can't.
Individuals and other congregations have set funds and other things to help.
Sure. Cindy.
I think a lot of times, like with the orphan homes and stuff, that people have used this as an excuse that, like, oh, we have to, you know, build an orphan's home. If there's a family within the congregation whose parents have died and the children are truly orphans, I think you would find it hard-pressed not to find enough families or a family that would be willing to take them in. We've known of a couple who, there was a case of a Christian family out in Colorado, I believe, and we were in North Carolina, and this one couple couldn't have children. They found out about a family whose children were truly orphaned. They adopted all four children and gladly finally got to have the family they wanted.
Yeah.
By adopting the children, a family, you know, a Christian family that they happened to pass away, there was nobody else to take them in, and they were just thrilled to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes we think, well, the only way we can do it is build this building or have an institution. No, we have family, and family takes care of family, and this is our other family. So
yeah.
If there's children that need homes, we would open our homes to them.
Sure, absolutely. Carol?
It's always easier to give money to a situation and let somebody else do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Yeah, well, I put a dollar in the collection plate. They send 10 cents to the orphan's home. Boy, good for me. No, that's not the way it works. Anybody else before we move on? The last one is, one church may send to several churches.
Yeah.
One church can receive from, it's axiomatic, isn't it, that one church may send to several churches.
Yeah,
we could do that easily. Tornado comes in and destroys two towns and the church is leveled and Christians are in need. They're in two different locations. East side sends two checks. Where's the scripture for it? Acts 11, 27 through 30. You don't do it if you don't have scriptural evidence for it. All right, number 7. We got about 4 minutes. I think we might be able to get through this one. And that is, well, I don't know if we can or not, explain 2 Corinthians 8, 1 through 5. So let's read it. Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that they, according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. And this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Gerald.
Simple summation. Be willing and generous to give and help those in need.
All right. That's succinct. It's right there. It's a good point. Anybody want to add to that or say anything else about it? Well, let's go again. What does 2 Corinthians 8, 9 teach us about caring for others? For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. What's that saying? First, who are we talking about? Okay, so how do you meld all that together?
He was God in heaven, rich in spiritual attributes.
Right.
And he became human,
right,
so that he could be the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
He became poor.
Absolutely. So the analogy would be, Christ is in heaven with the Father. Does this earth look like heaven, do you think? You think? Well, of course it doesn't.
Not with all the Johnson grass around.
Oh, yeah. Right. So he comes to the earth. He left heaven's glory. Philippians tells us all about that. He left heaven's glory and he came here and he became poor in the sense he didn't have a lot of this world's goods, but I don't think that's what that means. I think it's talking about the difference in living as a human being and suffering all of the temptations and all of the ills that we suffer. He became poor that you through his poverty. What does that mean? You through his poverty.
His humanness, that he came and suffered and died for us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the difference. Might become rich. So what he has done for us, I think, is the gist of that passage.
I think what it is that he humbled himself to serve us. And we need to humble ourselves and serve
right.
others. We not need to be high and mighty and say, we're too good to serve you.
And yeah. And what did he ultimately do?
He died.
He sacrificed his life. So we're to care for the needs of brethren, even if we have to sacrifice. We did not get finished, but we almost did. We'll take up with question 9 and 10 next week, and then we'll go into lesson 11. Thanks so much for your attendance, your comments this morning. I appreciate it.